Welcome to the Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 32. Now, something interesting about that. 32 is a freezing point of water in Fahrenheit. So I've got a feeling this episode is going to be pretty cool. So that's me done for the day.
Cooler than usual, so, maybe.
what's everyone been up to?
Well, I've been kind of got a couple of things there. Yeah, I've been playing with I've got a new small laptop I acquired, an HP 2530p. It's got 4 GB of RAM, it's got an SSD in it, and I've been just trying different distros on there, or Linux distros on there. Started off with my trusty Ubuntu, which is on my main PC. Then I sort of try out Ubuntu Mate, and quite enjoyed it, and that worked quite well and quite fast. But again, I still find it, I felt that quite, not backward, I just don't like the way the menu structure works on it. Then I thought, I tried Manjaro on there, and really liked it. And then I tried, I really like doing Arch because it's kind of a lightweight, but spent ages installing it. I basically wanted to get it working with the encryption of a full disk encryption. Got it installed, but then it wouldn't do the sound, wouldn't work, and I was getting annoyed with XFSE, wouldn't work correctly. So basically put Manjaro on it. Took me about a couple of hours to get it to working like I liked how I get it set up with all my key shortcuts and things. And basically, it's good. I mean, the only thing is that it's got quite a good loads of software you can install. It's got, I think there's a command you can run to install software, but there's actually like a little application you can run which you can search for to install. But one of the things I use quite a lot is a Notepad PPD or something. It's like Notepad +++ for Windows, but it's Notepad QQ. It's basically like Notepad Plus for Windows, but it means you can do search and replace, and it's just a lot better than the old the mouse. Is it like a mouse pad or something you can get, which is like the default one for?
Yeah, I've been using that. Yeah, thanks for the tip. Actually, I'm looking at that now. I'm installing it now, in fact.
Because I had, I had to basically, it's got a dev package, but it hasn't got I couldn't find it in their repo, so I basically had to do the download it and do make install or whatever. Those three commands you have to, or is it build?
Yeah.
Configure,
make, and make install. Yeah.
So got that working. It works fine. The only problem I had was that there. I had a problem with the Wi-Fi. I remember having this before. Is that it's an HP fault or something? Every time you boot up, the Wi-Fi would be disabled. Even if you press a little button on the laptop to enable it, it wouldn't come on. And there's a command you can run called rfkill unblock all. And that basically, when you do that, that basically unblocks all your Wi-Fi, and the Wi-Fi automatically connects. So. But a lot of people on the web are saying, you need to put it in like your startup script to run that RFQ unblock all. But it wouldn't work for me. But I did find on an Arch forum about it that you have to basically, I'll put it in the show notes, but you have to, in the etc folder under modprobe.d, whatever that is, /, you have to create a file called hp.config. And then you basically type, you basically type in a blacklist space HP hyphen WMMI, and when you put that in that file, when you reboot the laptop, it basically, I don't know what it does, but it enables the Wi-Fi on every reboot. So
I can give you a bit of detail there. So basically, the Linux kernel, the way that it's built with most distributions is it has a load of modules, so you can either compile everything into the kernel, and the kernel is what basically talks to the hardware and talks to you, so you can compile it all into the kernel, that's called a monolithic kernel, or you can compile it into separate modules, which is called a modular kernel, and then you load those modules get loaded in at boot time. So what you've done there with the blacklist is you've told it not to load this particular module, this particular kernel module, as it's booting, basically. And that's basically solved the issue. I haven't heard of that module before, HP_WMI. I don't know what it does, but it's a kernel module that was getting loaded in, and now it isn't.
All right, cool. I knew you'd know the answer for that. So, can you solve my other remaining issue? Is that
maybe?
Not that, if you will. I have a problem, but if you plug in the headphones in the laptop and you listen to it, and the music comes through the headphones, and the music before that is going out of the speakers, but if you unplug the speak and the microphone, the audio doesn't come out, and you have to, I don't know what you have to do to get it working again, but you have to either have to mute it or go into the control panel. I haven't worked out what you have to do to enable it, but after about 10 minutes,
right.
So I don't know what that's all about, so
yeah, I'd look in the log, journal CTL on Manjaro, to see if you can see anything there. And when you unplug and plug it in, and if it's not that, head towards pulse audio volume control, which we've been playing around with for getting the audio working for this very podcast. So give that a go, maybe.
Yeah, so that's all working, but it's all working configured how I like it now. So so what have you been up to, Andy?
Right, well, first of all, just going back onto something that we mentioned last week with the WordPress issue. So what we did, I managed to get access onto the cPanel of this particular site. And I was doing a bit of Googling around, looking to see what this problem could be. It was on Jerry's advice, but mostly as well. I mean, the file itself was, I forgot, not the top of my head, taxonomy file, dot something, can't remember what it was, and it said that there was an error.
Probably
in
PHP.
One, what was it, sorry,
probably .php, I would have thought.
Yeah I think it was, yeah,
yeah.
And the error was in the very last line of that file. It was the very last line. So just reading around, and I thought, what I could actually try and do is just replace the file itself, because I don't think that particular file gets modified in any WordPress, setup when you actually customize it yourself. I don't think that gets modified. So I went to WordPress.org and downloaded the WordPress zip file with all the files in, and then unzipped it and looked for that particular file. Because I had access to the cPanel, I went into the file manager of the cPanel and then just found the original file, which we're having the problem with, changed it to .old, just in case, and then uploaded this new version of the file. So I directly uploaded it, saved it, etc. Went to the website, everything working. So that all worked out pretty well. I don't know what caused the file to have a problem in the first place, or what did it, but anyway, that's what fixed it. I've got a couple of other things. One of them is just a possible bit of an idea or something. One of my customers has, so he had a PC, quite a decent spec. Now, he had a 250 gig SSD drive in it, which has been working great. Now, this guy is really into his games, and he's been downloading and buying different Steam games lately. And there's that much of it is... Well, his hard drive's getting full up, basically. He was installing everything onto C drive. He wanted to get a bigger SSD. So he ordered a terabyte SSD drive. Which I have to say, I think it was something like £330 or something like that. So so we got this drive. I went round and so I cloned it from the 250 onto the terabyte. And everything worked great. Actually, funnily enough, when I've done that before, when I've cloned a small drive onto a bigger drive, when you initially go into my computer to have a look at that disk, it's always initially been the same size. You know, so it only sees it, in this case, it's a 250. And then when you go into disk management, you can then allocate the, you know, expand the space into the rest of the drive. But on this occasion, it didn't. So I don't know what the difference was there. It just went straight to a terabyte available space, which is all right. So anyway, he's now gone up to a terabyte drive. Now, the question is, what kind of useful task can we give to this older 250 gig SSD drive? Could you think of any useful idea to keep it in the machine and have any kind of good use for it?
Probably use it as a system disk and then use the terabyte for storage, as you might do if you had a terabyte spinning drive or a multi-terabyte spinning drive.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
And I was thinking,
have you got room in the machine?
Would there be... Because I started thinking, oh, this could be really good. And then I'm thinking, what can actually... Could you use it as a... I know it's big, but as a extra allocate RAM to it, or could you page in file, use it for that, or something like that? Or
if you've the other drive is an SSD as well, so yeah. I don't know if there's advantage to it. Because yeah, I mean, one of my things. My daughter's got a laptop with a 500 gig spinning drive in it. And yep. I'm looking at cloning that spinning drive to SSD. But I'm going to have a 500 gig drive left over, which it seems a shame to waste it. You know, and I think I was actually looking at external drive cases or like some way to build a NAS with 2.5-inch drives or something. But they're pretty pricey. I mean, you couldn't really do it on the cheap, as it were. So, you know, it's kind of out of range, really.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought, you know, we've now got a terabyte SSD and a 250 gig SSD. You know, what good use can we put out of them both? I couldn't think of anything good. Yeah.
Have you got any other 250 gig SSDs?
No,
can start looking into RAID arrays, like RAID 0. RAID 0 and SSD should be quite fast.
He would, yeah. Yeah, that's an idea. Because he's got spinning drives. He's got 3 terabytes and a 1.5 terabyte in there for storage. So, you know, he's got plenty of room for that. But anyway, I just thought I'd try and get some ideas for it. But that'd be interesting as a RAID, wouldn't it?
Maybe another box and have a storage server or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. Well, that is it. He's got a NAS drive, but that's got 2 terabytes in it. I think it is as well. So, so that's something that I was thinking of as this week. Another thing we had as well, which I've got no answer to whatsoever, is in one of the estate agents that I do work for, over the past, I would say, year, was a decent amount of time, over the past year, there has been 3 computers fail with practically the same fault on the same desk and nowhere else. Just on that one desk. And I've got... It's just the owner was asking me, why does this keep happening? It's basically the motherboards are dead. You know, do everything to the motherboard to try and kick it back into life. BIOS resets, different RAM, even tried different power supplies, nothing, you know. And it's been a really strange situation where this one particular desk has had this, the same fault on three different computers. Basically, one of them's failed, and then they've brought another computer in that they've got somewhere else to shove it there. And then 6 months later, that one's failed with the same fault.
Is it the same user?
Yeah.
The whole time?
Yeah.
It could be the user.
Well, yes. You know, user error is one of the biggest things of killing. But I really don't know how you'd kill a kill a motherboard.
What's the actual fault?
Oh, right. Well, when I go to it, you know, they say they usually leave it on overnight. They leave it on. They come back to it the next morning. The tower appears to be running. You can hear the fans, but there's nothing on the screen.
So then it
won't turn off. So they've got to unplug it at the wall, plug it back in. When you hit the button to start the computer up, the fans kick in, and that's it.
Is there any beeps?
No.
Has it got a speaker plugged into it, into the motherboard?
I assume it has. Yes. Yeah.
Might be worth checking because you get beep codes on some.
Yes.
Motherboards, so you can diagnose what might be wrong that way. But
that's it. Well, I even tried taking the RAM out, because if you take the RAM out, you're definitely going to get some beep codes, aren't you? If you take the memory out.
Assuming you've got a speaker plugged into it.
Yeah, yeah. But then there's nothing with that.
It could be complete coincidence. It does happen.
Can I tell you a story? About it.
Okay, yeah.
So, this is the same sort of thing as a shop and a travel agent, okay? And there's a woman there who's really annoying, but that's, you get that sometimes with customers. And
annoying news is surely not.
And basically what happened is one of the computers kept dying and the screen kept going. Well, it looked like the computer had crashed. So every time this happened, we basically got the customer to just restart the machine and everything. And I don't know what she's doing, but basically, if we reset the machine, it would come back up okay. And okay, so we thought, all right, and we go in and we tried to fix it. So we basically said, oh, we'll do a swap out for you. We swapped the PC out and nothing, and again, we took the PC back, reformatted it, put everything back on it, ran on the test, nothing, like, hadn't worked on the workbench for like 48 hours, the screen didn't go black. But again, the woman was moaning that about an hour after she'd using the screen had gone black. So I was like, hang on, this is a bit odd. We swapped the PC over here. So we went back to the PC, we were on site anyway. So I basically took her main PC back to the site after working on things for 48 hours. And then what had happened was, I was on site doing some work. So they were all, give me a call over when it happened. So it happened. They went over. And what was happening was, it was the monitor that was going wrong, not the actual machine. It was like literally the machine, the monitor would go really, it'd go really, really dark. Like obviously the backlight was going on the thing. And then what she was doing is obviously just turning the monitor on and off to get it to work again. But
oh, God.
So that's in the 8 days. So it might be worth checking the monitor out. I don't know. It could be the monitor kind of thing. So,
well, yeah, I suppose that's a possibility. I mean, last time it happened, we took one of the other spare machines, plugged it in, and it came up straight away. You know, plug in the faulty one. It is a bit odd. It could be a coincidence. And the owner said to me as well, he said, could electrics have anything to do with this? And I said, why do you say the electrics, you know? He said, it's just something that happened here years ago about some kind of overloading and things like that. I said, well, it is possible. I mean, you know, you have these surge protection plugs and everything to prevent against any kind of dips or spikes in the power, which you can blow things. It's not on one, it's not on a surge protector, so.
You would have thought that would get the power supply first, though, wouldn't you?
You'd have thought so, yeah. And the other day I did plug in a different power supply, you know, just in case it had lost one voltage or something like that.
Maybe you...
It was definitely getting a 12 volts because the fans were spinning.
Maybe you could put an extension lead in from another point in the office.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was a thought, you know, if it's maybe it's next to a wall which has got a massive cable in it, and somehow that's causing problems with, you know, it's just, or two wires and it's the interference pattern is hitting the motherboard in a certain way or something, but yeah. I guess it's just trying to nail down what the actual fault is with the motherboard, like if it's beeping at you or whatever, or something like the disc light going blinking three times or something like that, maybe. There can be codes like that.
The only other common thing is, all of them have been the same model PC as well. So there's another possibility that the PC is, they're all failing with the same fault at about the same age.
Yeah, bad hardware. You know,
the hardware's bad batch, failing. Sort of yeah, thing. Exactly. Yeah, that's the other possibility. Yeah. But saying that, they've got quite a few of these others in different desks around the place, and they've been running. They've had no problem with any of the others. So that was another weird one. I mean, we've got no kind of answer for that at all at the minute. I mean, at the minute, they need a computer backup. Yeah. I'm going back with a new machine on Monday and getting it all going for them. But
it's like we had a problem with like Acer desktops. We bought like 20 of them when I was working for another company, and they all slowly died one after another. They all died with the same fault kind of thing.
Right.
Like their old motherboard, it was their motherboard wouldn't, you couldn't, it would like lose the hard, its IDE controller, so it couldn't see the thing. But we knew the whole 20 of we bought in a big batch kind of thing, all of them slowly died over 20. So.
Over to, yeah.
Was it after the warranty period?
Yes, about that? A month.
Oh, right. Makes sense.
So that's that. So the other thing I've got is something to say, because this happens in Windows and Linux, no doubt. But I was thinking about, you know, when you're doing, if you're doing kind of any kind of monitored services on people's machines or you know, what do you call it, you know, preventative maintenance and stuff like that. There's all sorts of things that you can connect to remotely and do it manually and stuff like that. But what kind of things can you set up in the likes of scheduled tasks that you would otherwise have to do manually? How could you automate it? And what can you automate? And how would you do it? That's the other thing I've been thinking about this week. I don't know if I've got any. I mean, say, for example, you wanted to clean out the temp files once a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of having to remote onto the machine and do it manually every week, surely you could do a scheduled task to run something to delete it every Sunday morning at 1 o'clock or something, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep.
So what else could you do similar to that, and how would you do it?
Well, you'd have to use scheduled tasks and Windows to schedule it, but there's loads of things you can do. Like, I'm guessing you could do things like checking. You can set up alerting if it gets any errors in the event log, or look for certs and events in the event log. To kind of tell you what it is, to if it, because you can set up alerts so that if an event happens, it would email you out. You do things like you could defrag the hard drive, kind of thing.
All right, yeah.
I guess you could run that disk scan tool or that disk cleanup tool. I'm guessing you could automate that to be run once a week to empty all the files. But there's so many things you can do. Anything you could script, you could get it, because we've got the PowerShell scripting. If you had PowerShell installed on the machine, you could run scripts doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in Linux, there's something called cron, which is sort of it's been around for ages, and it's used for all sorts of things. Yeah, I mean, it's used in on you know, production servers to make sure things are copied to the right places, you know, write out log files or basically, yeah, anything, because it's all shell based. You have your scripts in cron run at a certain time, and it's very widely used.
So task scheduler is just like a timer in a way. At this point in time, do this script.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Now the actual scripts themselves. I mean, you said there's thousands of things you can do. Is there anywhere you can download pre-made scripts, or how would you write them yourself, and what would they be written in?
No one writes their own scripts. I was listening to a podcast.
I write my own scripts.
Someone's,
I guess, it's more complicated with PowerShell.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of things I just Google it and find. I basically just Google it and find out what other people have done, and then basically put it.
Yeah.
So you got the normal batch file scripts you can do, Andy. So just kind of Googling what people have done, and then you can just work out what they've done and modify it to your own thing. Like, you could maybe you want to generate a report what shows the disk space uses on a machine, kind of thing. And then that you could do a little script so that then emails you that, or the disk usage, or how many people have logged on that week, kind of thing. Things like that. Whatever. There's so many things you can do. If you go to the schedule tasks and control panel or administration tools on a server, you can do loads of things by set it where it run it, how long you want to run it. Do you want to run it once a day or once a week, or do you want to run it every 20 minutes or something, kind of thing? Because some people like the principle of other than the past where you can run a scheduled task every 20 minutes, restart the principler, or 20 minutes, every 20 minutes, check to see if the principler is running. If the script says, oh, if it's stopped, start it, kind of thing.
Is scheduled tasks based around PowerShell then?
No.
Or is it more object orientated, I suppose? So, like you were saying, for instance, check the event log for this thing, and then do something based on that.
No.
So if this, then
so basically, it's like the cron jobs. You basically say at this time, run this application or run this script with this permissions, kind of thing, and that's it.
Say you found you get a script to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
So say it's a batch file, right?
Yeah.
And then so you can double click that batch file and run it any time you want.
Mm-hmm.
Now you then can shove that batch file in some hidden directory somewhere, and then tell task scheduler to run it. I get the principle of it, yeah. It's just getting the batch. I'll have to look around, see what kind of batch files there is. The reason they come up is because sometimes there's things I've put something on someone's machine at some point, or I left somebody with years ago, Service Pack 3 on XP or something like that. And I said, right, I've left them to it basically. And they said, oh yeah, okay, that's Service Pack 3, I want to run that. That would leave them to run it, but eventually I want to get rid of it. Because you don't need that setup file anymore. And I thought it'd be handy if I could just connect up in a week's time or something and delete that damn file.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're probably not going to do it. So if I could schedule it to delete it automatically, then that would be useful.
Yes.
So in that kind of case, you could make a batch file to say, delete this particular file. Go into task scheduler. So you do a one-off thing in task scheduler as well.
Yeah.
Just do one-off, one time, run, and that's it.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Or you can every day, every week, things like that.
Yeah. So basically, you run a script. Say it's like in C, Windows. I normally quite fond of called script. And script, you could have something we have sometimes where servers need rebooted once a week. So we just have a bat file that says reboot.bat. BAT or whatever. And then in the scheduled task, you just create a new scheduled task and you say, run this script, run C colon back to script slash reboot.bat. And set the permissions up on who's got permissions to run it. So if you need to add permissions to have what the user's got permissions, because it won't run under, you can have to run the system permissions, but that might not have the permissions to do the job. So you might have to give it admin rights to run that script.
Okay. Yeah. I'd have to try that.
With like my Linux boxes, I get an email. Like every morning, I'd run a number of tasks running cron, which basically one emails me what updates are available. Another one is it basically emails me to tell me it's got basically logs from all the different logs in Linux. What tells me, so there's any issues or anything. How many
is that a log watch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can remember what I need. Yeah, and that basically just tells like how many people are connected remotely, how many messages it sent. And also, I've got a number of scripts where it backs up. Basically, first of all, it backs up MySQL databases. So I've got quite a lot of WordPress sites and one thing, so it backs them all up into one tar file. And then another script basically tars that into another tar with all the website files in the www directory. And then I've got a third script which basically rsyncs that back to my home server at home. So I've got an off-site copy of the backups.
I've got a script that can... It basically backs all the MySQL databases up individually. Yours might be doing that already, but with MySQL, you can either back up one database or all databases. And this will actually go in, find out all the databases that are on MySQL, and then back up each one individually. It's quite handy.
Yeah.
So basically, you can restore them individually rather than all in one go.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look at what the script does to what the script does.
It sounds like how Acronis and these different backup softwares are. That all that they are is their own task scheduler and their own scripts.
Hmm.
And if you did I was
struck by that with there's a bit of sort of enterprise backup software we use at work called NetBackup. It's a Symantec product, but it's got a big GUI and everything, but all it really is a scheduler. So it says this backup job runs then, and what it does is it gets all these files, talks to the tape drives and backs them up to the backs the particular files up to a particular set of tapes, and all it is a scheduler really.
So effectively, if you could make a batch file and use something like I don't know if you use it nowadays, like xcopy users / my documents to eDrive / backup, and then do a task schedule on it like once a day, then that would back that. Yeah. That would do that once a day, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, the backup system I use for a lot of my clients is called rsnapshot. And that basically, it runs the command rsnapshot hourly, daily, or weekly, and it runs it at specified times using cron. So it does its clever stuff when it's run, but it has to be told to run at a certain time by cron. And I suppose that goes back to the sort of Unix philosophy of doing everything does one thing and does it well.
Yeah.
So you've got cron there, so you don't need to build that functionality into the rsnapshot package because you use cron to do it instead.
The SQL I use is called Auto MySQL Backup version 3, which basically does all the backs up all the databases separately, and it auto rotates them as well to different things. What I'd like to do ideally at some point is have another CentOS box at my home and then have another script the other end which basically unpacks it all and then restores them kind of thing and then make sure that it actually works, if you know what I mean. So
You could use rsnapshot with that and MySQL replication, so you're just replicating the databases straight to another instance of MySQL. I haven't played around with that, but I keep meaning to.
Cool. So what have you been up to, Jerry?
I know. Well, quite a few things. Might be a bit of a change on the horizon for my day job. Right. I went for an interview yesterday in London for what's sort of billed as a DevOps role. Now, I don't know exactly what DevOps means, but it's basically a sysadmin still, but a sysadmin maybe that does a bit more. Works more closely with developers, I suppose. So we'll have to see how that goes. It sounds good. It sounds like I might be the only sysadmin there, which is a little bit scary. But yeah, hopefully I'm up to the challenge.
Wow, excellent.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. You may hear more about it in the next few weeks. So yeah, keep an ear out. Couple of new freelance clients. Someone came to me, wanted me to look after. They've got about 12 servers, which most of my clients have got one server, and it does all their web serving. It's got MySQL databases on, and it sometimes does mail as well. That's the sort of standard server I get to look after. But this guy's got about 12 or so servers, most of them web servers, but then a couple of them database servers. So the database, the websites talk to the database, but they talk to it on a different server, which is architecturally, that's probably a better way of going, because when your database is tied up, your websites still run. So yeah, maybe a better way of going, but he doesn't actually use Plesk or cPanel for his websites, which is unusual, but it's probably, you know, the way I'd prefer to see things, but because none of my other clients do it, it's been like, oh, what's going on here then? I have to do a bit more work. No GUI. What's going on here? So yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, there's another guy who has got, he's one of those single server people, but he's got about 200 gigs of data that he wants me to back up. So I'm looking into getting another VPS with more storage to do that. Basically using the R snapshot technique I just mentioned, but sort of provisioning that and the thought of having another server to look after. It's okay, but it's again, it's something new. So yeah, that's all interesting. And I've got a client who, my first ever client actually, he's got a Nagios infrastructure and he wants to move the central server to AWS. So I'm looking at the EC2, which is the VMs basically that they supply, and RDS, which is the managed database offering. It doesn't look that managed to me from what I can see, because there's a load of setup that you have to do. It's one of those things I'm going to have to follow up on. I know I always say that, and I'm fairly aware that I never do follow up on these things. So I'm going to go through old episodes and find out what I said I would follow up on, because it's almost certainly done by now, and actually follow up on some of those things. So then the last thing is I'm putting GitLab, which is basically a kind of self-hosted GitHub. You may have heard about it in other Linux podcasts if you listen to them. They do a sort of hosted Git repository type offering, but they also supply that software for you to run on your own server, and it's really good. I mean, I put it in at work, and it works really well, looking after our Puppet code on that. You can do things like, the repository sits on the GitLab server, and then you can use that to push code to places, you know, share the code, merge the code on the server and then push that out and things like that. But in their case, they're taking their existing code base, which is basically just the file's sitting on the web server, which is serving the production website, and the main bit of work at the moment is importing that into GitLab, and then getting them to actually use GitLab to do their development, basically branching the code off, doing the development, testing it, and then merging it back into production when they're ready, rather than just working on the production server, which is incredibly dangerous if you've got your business running on it. And yeah, so doing it that way. And then also using that Git repository to deploy the code to a backup server, just in case the production server fails. So I've got a script in place to do that in the moment, but that's kind of really basic. Sync this from server A to server B, dump the databases on server A, copy them over to server B, and then restore them. So I'm going to be looking at using Git to keep all that in sync. So yeah, that's my my little list.
Did you say the one with the guy that loads the web servers? Is that what are they running on, Linode? What's that? Is that?
Yeah. Linode's basically a hosting provider, but they let you just spin up. They've got certain servers with say one CPU or two CPU, 4 gig of RAM, 2 gig of RAM or whatever, and you can just, they've got a nice web interface to deploy these things, so it's quite easy to get a server going by just going to the website and, you know, putting in credit card details. A little bit like DigitalOcean, I suppose, but they've been around for longer.
Alright.
I think they had some problems a few years back. They got hacked. But, I think that was reported in Linux Outlaws. I'm not sure what the outcome was, but I think the Linux Outlaws had their web stuff on a Linode, so that obviously affected them. I mean, it's not, just looking at the website, it's quite a friendly website, and it makes it quite easy to just spin something up and get going. Yeah. And they've got various OSs that you can just put on there.
Okay, so that's like DigitalOcean then. So that's cool.
So that's my little list. I will follow up on this list in a future podcast.
Yeah. Well, I've got an interesting talk about. I've been doing quite a lot with IPS IDS solutions at work. Don't know if you heard of those before, guys. It's basically IDS, IPS. So basically, it's either intrusion detection system or infection pretend. No, that's wrong. Intrusion detect. Yeah, or intrusion prevention systems. I'll just basically copy and paste something wrong this way. And that's basically what I've been looking at. So we've got a customer's got a requirement. They've got to have this, an IPS IDS solution in their system to get their license, basically, to work. And basically what this is basically, it looks at the network to see if there's any traffic, what shouldn't be happening. So it looks at the network traffic and looks at signatures and sees if people are trying to hack something. So if you've got an IIS web server, it will look for known vulnerabilities in the network traffic. So if it sees that someone's trying to do cross-scripting or someone's trying to hack a MySQL database by just adding username and passwords in, it will basically detect it. So there's two ways of doing this. You've got the IDS, which is basically intrusion detection system, which basically just alerts you if it finds something. And what you normally deal for this is you have I heard talk about this before, about a mirror port. So when you're in your network, you have all your network connections, and those network connections, you basically have a mirror port of that network connection. So any traffic on that port will be basically duplicated on this mirror port. And on that mirror port, you'd have something like this IDS solution, which is basically a Linux, basically everything normally written based on this program called Linux program called Snort. which basically looks at traffic, and then it will obviously cover you replicate the traffic and put it out on this port. And obviously, what the little thing is, what's happening is it will look at the traffic and it will look at its definitions. And if it sees something it doesn't like, it will basically alert on it. Whereas an IDS, which is an intrusion prevention system, will basically put it in line. So it's kind of like if you've got your internet connection and you've got your main switch, what you would do is you basically put a connection from your internet connection into your IPS solution, and then on the other port, so it'd have like two network connections in it, you'd put that cable back into your switch. And what that means is that all your traffic is being routed through this device, and what the traffic doesn't know about this device. And if it sees hacks or whatever, it will basically drop the packets happening and it will stop the traffic going through. So the problem I've been looking at is a thing called Cisco Firepower, which is basically runs Snort. I don't know if you ever used that before, Jerry.
I've heard of it. I've never got as far as configuring it or looking at it. I've kind of investigated it for something and decided I didn't need it. I think that's what it came down to. So it's using checksums. It's checking the data that's coming in, like the raw data.
Yes,
I guess against the so did like the TCP data.
Yes.
Against whatever's in its database.
Yeah, so it's basically has other definitions and it basically just checks it. And it's very clever stuff, I think. So
yeah,
that's an interesting thing.
There's a similar, well, I say it's similar, but it's something on Apache, the famous web server. There's a thing called Mod Security, which will look at the stuff coming in and check it against known bad stuff. So, I mean, that's a sort of application level thing, but yeah, different to what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, so you basically get the, if you get the two sorts, so you get IPS, IDS, so the IPS is the prevention and the detection, because some people don't want that in line, because obviously if you've got like a gig connection to the internet, you've got to have quite a powerful machine to deauthorize, to look at the packets, look at them and then put them, rebuild them again and put them back on the wire again. So
how does that work with TLS as well? I mean, I guess it doesn't essentially, or unless it decrypts everything.
Well, I'm guessing.
And then checks.
Yeah,
it,
I don't know. That's kind of thing that went through my mind a minute ago when we were talking about this. How does it deal with TLS kind of thing?
I guess you have to terminate it in front of the IPS box and then run it through. But then, yeah, that could be going straight to the browser. Mm. So it's going past the IPS. Yeah.
And the other thing I was talking about last week was about reply to all storms in your... I found an interesting blog. I'll put a link in the show notes to it. But it was talking about what happens if someone replies all to an email. I mean, probably what happens doesn't really matter in your little small company, but if you've got thousands and thousands of users... So I don't know if you ever had... I've never had to kind of deal with this. But I've been on email chains where people are going, remove you from the list kind of thing. And if it's gone there, yeah. If it's gone for like, I remember like ages ago, like it was on like, must have been on some sort of mailing list where everyone was on the mailing list or they got hacked or something. I don't know. So let's say that if you haven't had the pleasure, let's say there's a guy called Vince emailed 33,000 people at once.
So, how did he manage that? Was that a distribution list, or was it
maybe
33,000 individual people?
Well, if you think about it, like if some of the companies, like I have, like we've got like an all sites email, and you can expand that, can't you? Because normally, if you apply to a distribution group,
yeah.
If someone's expanded that distribution group, obviously then it puts everyone's email address, so email to everyone. So around 700.
If it's go on. If it's a DL. Does it is there any kind of deduplication that goes on there? So say you send to a DL entire company, does that make a copy in everyone's mailbox?
Depends what mail server you've got, basically. Because like I said,
with Exchange,
yes,
or is it with a version of it?
Depending what version of Exchange you've got in it, really.
Okay.
So basically, if you've got around 700 people replied to all in the first 4 hours, which added up to over 2 million emails in the first 4 hour period.
Blimey. You're in the notes, it says 20 million. You're showing you haven't missed off a zero there.
Sorry, 20 million. So. Yeah, so then you think
that's quite a lot of emails.
So people are like saying, why am I on this list? Premiere me from my list. And then the people that replied at all. And then people reply back saying, please remove me as well. And then you've got to think about things like out of offices. And the problem you've got is that transport servers can't deal with that overwhelming discharge too. And you've got the IO operations of doing it. So so you've got re-receipts as well on that as well. So you've got to think of consideration. But I'll put the link in the show. But a couple of things, a way to stop this is to stop in the... If your emails are going to distribute, the first step is to block the distribution is to list from even from external users. So if this happens and then people like externally, you can in Exchange, by default, if you take a DL, just distribution list, it's people from externally can't reply to that group. So, but also the way to do it is in the transport rules, I don't really know about these in Exchange, is that you can basically like in Outlook, you can create rules what say if someone comes sends you this email or email in this subject line, put it to a certain folder, like in the rules in Outlook. You can do that on an Exchange level. So what you could do is you could say if someone replies to his email or his email's got this in it, delete that email. So it doesn't even get to people's emails. So when it goes through the SMTP service, it basically will drop it at that point. I didn't know you could do that in Exchange because I'm doing this Exchange migration. I was just doing a bit of Googling and found that someone said that these SMTP transport rules aren't easily transported between Exchange 2007 and 2013. And I went and looked, and this customer I'm doing it for has got 15 rules. There's a nice PowerShell script will basically do it for you, migrate it from Exchange 2007 to 2013. So that's how to stop it. That's basically how to stop this. But how do you prevent it? Well, what you can do is with distribution groups, you can basically say who can send that group. Okay. So normally when anyone can send a distribution, but say if you've got like 33,000 users, I would basically say, yeah, only certain people can send to that list. So only like, whoever you want it. But also you can basically do message approval. So people can send messages to that distribution group, but you can tell people that if you send this email to this group, someone else has got to authorize it, which is quite interesting. And also mail tips as well. But it's like a thing in... I don't know if you notice this in Outlook, if you've got a certain version of Exchange, if you start typing to someone too, and they're out of the office, and they've got an alert, if they're out of office alert on, it will basically put up a little tip, will tell you that it will, that it's, that you, that that person's out of the office before you send it and get the out of office back kind of thing. So you can basically put a mail tip on saying that if you send them to a large distribution group, it will say, look, you're sending to a large distribution group. And if you've got the box, what says you've got to be approved by a group manager before it's sent, it'll basically do a little social tip. It'll do. And then obviously the last thing I was thinking about is that you can limit the maximum recipient count. So you can basically say people can't send more than 100 people at a time kind of thing. So if they did, if someone did do a expand it all and then extend it to everyone, then everyone replied back to it, you could say that only... that person, everyone's only can send to 100 people, then obviously people...
Does that just send to the first 100, or does it send to say there's too many recipients?
Yeah, it basically says too many recipients.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Cool. Yes, but it's basically a lot of the techniques you use in firewalling, in Linux anyway, in IP tables. You can say, like, you can limit the amount of packets that come in a certain time, or you can drop packets that are destined for a certain port. It's effectively a higher level with emails,
yeah.
Is what you're doing here, isn't it? So it's quite interesting. Because as far as I know, you don't get that functionality, at least in the basic stuff, with the Linux mail stuff. But again, I'm probably not knowledgeable enough. If anyone knows differently out there in the ether, feel free to let us know.
Did you say you're going to put a bigger hard drive in your daughter's laptop, Jerry? Did you say?
It was an SSD, so she's got a spinning drive, and I'm wanting to put an SSD in because it really chugs along at the moment. it's the only thing I think in the house without an SSD in it now. So, and it's kind of a tablet, you know. It's one of those ones that where you can fold the screen right back and it becomes a tablet sort of thing.
Okay.
And I was going to put Windows 10 on it as well, so I wanted to put the SSD in before doing the Windows 10 upgrade. Okay.
And you're going to use DD to copy it, were you?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I mean, everything that I looked up online said that would be okay, but I was wondering if going from spinning drive to SSD, there was anything to keep in mind there.
No, nothing. I mean, you could use clone dither. That's what I would use to clone it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that basically uses DD in the background, doesn't it? Yeah.
Because I've actually used DD this time for the first time to actually write an ISO to a USB disk. Because normally I use something else in Windows to burn disks, ISO images to USB sticks. But sometimes it doesn't always work in Windows. I can't remember, Ubuntu or you, and I kind of like what I use to Ubuntu.
Unit.
And then
booting.
I find a nice.
Unit.
Yeah, unit booting or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But sometimes it hasn't been working very well lately with the latest distro, so I've been using that in Windows. My Linux boss has been doing a DD, which I was quite scary working, but I'm guessing when you learn it, it's quite working.
Yeah. I've got a little tip as well. I'll find the URL with it, but you know how DD, you basically run it and then it just stays there and you don't know how far it's got or anything.
Yeah.
You can send a kill command, but not a kill the whole lot command. What the kill command does in Linux is it sends a signal to a process, and you can vary that what it sends to give different results. And so if you do kill minus uppercase USR1 and then the PID number, so in Linux, every process has a number. So you find out that number and send this signal, USR1. It prints out how much it's copied. So that way you can get some information on how the progress is going of DD. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Cool. Because I found
it's handy.
I found a little tool which through the Ubuntu Mate site says how to burn it. Called Win32 Disk Imager, and that basically just writes images to USB sticks. So you haven't got to worry about what formatting it was. So if you've got an ISO, you just basically download the ISO and it burns it to the disk. So I'm guessing it's just basically doing DD in Windows, basically, I'm guessing. So.
Yeah, I've used that before for Win32 Disk Imager.
Mm.
Just for writing, because sometimes you get IMG files which you've got to write to somewhere. I think I might have used it for imaging a floppy drive onto a USB stick or something for like a boot floppy drive back in the day. Rings a bell anyway.
Here's one for you, Andy. Apparently if you turn on ITV +1, England is still winning.
Yay.
Just make sure you turn it off in the next 10 minutes or so.
That's right, we've got to rewrite the history books. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, England have been playing Wales in the Rugby World Cup tonight. So, and England lost.
Oh, spoilers. What if someone's listening to this and hasn't listened to the game yet?
So we're all unhappy over here. But, yeah, so there we go.
Cool. Have you got a podcast tip there?
Radiolab, which is, I may have mentioned it around Christmas last year. They're basically a really well-produced podcast, American. And this week they're talking about basically hacking viruses and that sort of thing. And they talk about Crypto Wall, but they do it in a kind of interesting way. They're not a techie podcast as such, but you kind of see the story unfolding. And for those of you that don't know how Crypto Wall works, I'm not going to spoil it here. I'm going to let you listen to the podcast. But it goes into, it talks about things like DDoS attacks and botnets, which is, you know, script kiddies and things like that, which is things that we all know what they are, but it's explaining them to the layman. It's quite interesting. And I think it's interesting that this stuff is coming into sort of public knowledge, that the layman is starting to learn about these things. I thought that was quite interesting. It's called Dark Code.
Okay.
This particular episode.
You had a DDoS attack, didn't you, Al, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, one of our customers did.
Yeah, we've got a podcast about that. So
good. Yeah. Also wanted to this is a bit of a kind of a thing I'm gonna do, but basically I've been watching this thing on YouTube called The Scene. It's basically it's an old pro. Well, it's like a. It was basically come out in 2004. It's basically like a mini series, but basically it's before the day of YouTube and stuff. And every week you download this little video for like 20 weeks. It's about this hacking group. Well, it was in the days of when the peer to peer first came about, and where people would go in and try and get the movies up on the line first. So they're not like the ones who people putting the camera in the thing, but basically getting proper DVD copies from the people who make them and then upload them. And it's all about how the FBI tried to basically infiltrate them and try and get them down. It's basically, it's not very good, but it's quite interesting to watch. Basically, like, it's a, you basically watch the RIC channel, which is like an internet relay channel, and you basically see a different week from a different person's point of view kind of thing. So you can see people typing, and it's quite interesting. I'll put a link in the show notes to it in there, and the link to the YouTube videos kind of thing. So it took me back to the day when I was, yeah.
Some good channels I've been getting into the, that you mentioned it, maybe at Christmas, about the Numberphile YouTube channel.
I love the Numberphile channel and the Computer File channel.
Yeah,
I love it. I think I'd watch most stuff on more stuff on YouTube, but I'd actually watch more mainstream TV, I think. I just basically just subscribe to everything, and then every day I look at my subscribe and see what's come out. Cutting.
That's right. Mm. There's a lot of people who listen to more podcasts and than radio, and they watch no TV. You know, it's all audio.
Yeah. So. To be honest, since I got my Chromecast, I watch most BBC stuff on iPlayer. It's quite unusual that I actually watch live TV now. And you know, you've got Netflix, Now TV, and obviously YouTube. There's not, well, apart from anything else, no time to watch anything else.
And I've gone other days would say, you know, things like, did you see such and such on at 8 o'clock last night? You know, not many people actually watch things as they're on. We don't ourselves, you know. We've got a skybox, so it's 99% of it's recorded and watched later, you know.
That on that Numberphile thing this week, they had a woman who was saying about how you can cut any shape out with one cut in a bit of paper. Like, it's quite interesting. So you basically see, wow. So you can fold bits of paper up and then cut it, and it will make, we have one cut and it will make a shape. Like they're making the star, apparently, from the for the American flag kind of thing. So yeah, it's interesting. I'll put a link in this.
There's a really good one on
another thing.
Sorry, yeah, that said, sorry. I think it's a question. It was one minus one plus one minus one plus one minus one. Right, and that goes on forever. What's the answer?
No, I should know the answer to this. I've seen that video.
Yeah, and
is it minus a half or something like that? Or?
Yeah, it's a half.
It's half, yeah.
Yeah, because it goes on forever. You take an average. But I like sort of like quirky, like little questions like that. That on first look, you know, seems so simple. You know, one minus one plus one. Oh, that's easy enough. But as soon as you bring infinity into the equation,
there's never that guy. There's a couple of like, and there's that other one as well. Tom Scott. Have you checked out his YouTube channel as well?
I haven't. No, is he on the number five?
So. I think he might be one of the people who kind of organises the thing, and he's got like a good little channel. Kind of thing, and he kind of does like a thing a week, the different things. Like he was the other day, he was showing you like if you're in the Navy, what you have to go through the training. Like there's like a thing where like it shows you like if they have a breach, what they have to do, kind of thing. Like basically sticking like getting wedges and stuff, and everyone has to do this thing. It's really good little YouTube. It's literally like things you wouldn't know, kind of like. But basically, like
I just googled him actually. That Tom Scott guy. He's done some really good computer file videos.
Yeah.
About like one's called How Not to Store Passwords. Floating point numbers. But yeah, quite sort of relevant things to us, really, I suppose.
It's really good. He comes
and he's really, he explains things really well. He's quite enthusiastic, isn't he? So
He was saying about there's one about what the secret grand underground pipeline across Britain is. Like there's like, I don't know if you've seen it, like the metal pipes all around the UK kind of thing, when they were doing like in the Cold War, they're basically how they were shipping the aeroplane before the around the UK. Another one as well about the first man. He basically taxidermied himself after he'd, not himself, but he basically got him one himself taxidermied afterwards. And it's got a bit of a graphics in it, but apparently like they basically had to basically put his stuff, it's actually like a model because people were stealing it between universities or something. It's like a challenge kind of thing in like the 1900s or something. So and there's another one, that computer file, is it object file as well, where they basically just go looking around the objects and like in the Royal Society kind of thing as well.
Objectivity.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's Brady Haran, who he did a lot of the number file ones.
Yeah.
But he's also got a podcast called Hello Internet with CGP Grey. Is it CGP Grey's got some good videos as well. Not really that techie, but quite good.
And the other thing is like
I also just wanted to get in there, shout out for some BBC stuff. There's one about there's a documentary about Ada Lovelace, who wrote the first computer program. That's on iPlayer at the moment. There's a radio series. It's like 10-minute programs about computing, about probably since the 1980s. Cool, I think that's called Computing in Britain. And there's one by Marcus de Sotoy about algorithms, which is really good as well. All of those should be on iPlayer, so yeah, seek them out. They're good.
What was that other one
links
called?
In the show notes, probably.
Tom Scott, did you say it was?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've just pulled him up. Yeah, I've got him then. See, here's a question. Here's a video he's got. What do the numbers on Toaster Dial mean?
That's a good video. You should watch that.
I'm going to watch that when we finish.
Very good video. Another one to watch is that question. Colin Fursey guy, or Colin, and he's his mate as well. And he makes really good things. Like he made a high voltage ejecting bed, and he's currently building a a bunker in his backyard at the moment, kind of thing. So he's got the world.
That's not a crazy Russian hacker, is it? Or
no,
seen that?
No.
He's on YouTube, but I haven't actually watched any of his videos. But maybe something to follow up in the later episodes. Another thing.
Good. We can go through all people's what they've got on their YouTube description. Yeah. I've got over 100, I think. So
we should be doing this on our special Christmas episode, yeah. Shouldn't we? Yeah. We don't want to spoil it too much.
Good. All right. So. Yeah, we haven't had any emails in lately, have we? Will anyone help?
No.
You can email us at...
Hopefully, we've still got some listeners out there, hopefully.
Yeah. No. People are still downloading us, so that's good.
That's good, yeah.
So you can email us at...
So what's the email address then?
It's mail at adminadminpodcast.co.uk.
Don't forget social media as well. We're on all the big social media sites. So, yeah.
Okay, people, we'll end the show. We'll speak to you all soon.
Yep, see you next week.
Bye.
Bye for now.